This morning's
Agadita is a medrash. It actually appears in multiple places in different versions. I came across it over Sukkos. I was learning Koheles Rabbah for Shabbos Cholamayit Sukkos, and I came across this medrash there. It's pretty famous. There's another version of it in Medrash Rabbah and Kedoshim. So that's two places. There's a third version of it in the Medrash Tanchuma, which, if you look at the back page, you will find. The story is, I think, a very important one, as I usually do. Otherwise, I wouldn't choose it, I guess. And my interpretation of it is in some bizarre way inspired by Aesop's fables. I'll explain what I mean when we get into it a little bit. But the story is about Hadrian, who was an emperor, Roman emperor, and was responsible for some of the most vicious persecution of Jews during the after the Churban HaBayis. He was ultimately responsible for the martyrdom of Rabbi Akiva, Rabbi Chanan ben Trajan, and the Asar HaRugei Malchus. So he was really not a good guy, to say the least. And the Medrash tells the following story. I'm going to try to finish a little earlier than in the past so that I don't go too much into Morning Seder. So we're not going to read the whole thing, but we'll start it. This is from the Medrash Rabbah and Parshas Kedoshim. Adrianus Schik Tmaya, Hadrian, may his bones be ground. Sometimes it appears in Shas as Schik Atzomos. Here it's Schik Tmaya, more Aramaic. He wasn't, the author of the Medrash was obviously not a fan of his, because that was his part of his name. Hadrian Schik Atzomos. You know, that's Hadrian grind his bones up to dust. So, obviously, he's not the author of the Medrash is not a fan of his, for very good reasons. In any case, the story is not a bad story. That's part of the irony. He doesn't come out looking so bad in this particular story. He comes out actually looking reasonable in some ways. So, Hava Avar Be'ilein Shvilaya de Tveria. He was walking along the paths of Tveria. It's kind of interesting to imagine this great emperor. Sort of, we've all been around Tveria, we've been around the Galilee, kind of walk the paths. So imagine Hadrian kind of like walking along the paths of Tveria. So the scene is an interesting one. Vachama chad gvar sav, he saw an old man, ka'em, upright, chatsev chatsuvin, Leminsav Nitzivin, digging ditches in order to plant trees. So he's walking along and he sees this really old man digging ditches. And his purpose was to plant trees. Amale. So Hadrian said to him, Sava Sava. Old man, old man. I karatzt lo chashacht. If you had planted, this is the way most Mepharshim understand it, it's a little obscure. All the Mepharshim try to interpret it, Mepharshim on the Medrash, but this seems to be a more common interpretation. Ikaratzt, if you, when you were young, you planted trees so that when you were old you would be able to eat from their fruit, well, that makes sense. Lo chasacht, but now that you're old, what's the point of planting trees? Because you're not going to benefit from the fruit. Which is a good question. Why is this old man planting trees? It's going to take a while for the trees to bear any fruit. Amarle kritzas v'chashikas. I planted both when I was young as well as when I was old. Ma dehane lamare shmaya avet. Whatever Hashem wants to do with me, He wants to enable me to live to eat the fruit of the tree, fine. If not, not. I am in Hashem's hands. Whatever is good for him is good for me. Amalek, he said to him, B'chayecha, by your life, Sava bar kama shninat yomadein. How old are you today? Amalek, he said to him, bar me'oshnin. I'm 100 years old. That is pretty old. It's pretty old by contemporary standards. Can you imagine a 100-year-old man today planting a tree? You know, digging ditches to plant a tree? In those days, it was even more astonishing because the mortality rate for adults was much higher than it is today. It's not... It happens that one meets up with a 100-year-old man. Typically, though, I don't know the exact mortality rate in those days, but it may have been 40, 50, 60, you know. 100 years old was really quite remarkable. Amale, he said to him, V'ad bar ma'ashnin, you're 100 years old. V'kayim v'chotziv chatsuvin l'minsav nitsivin, you're getting up and you're digging ditches to plant trees. Svar da'ad achel mahon, do you think you are going to be able to eat from the fruit of these trees? Amale, he said to him, In zachis acholis, if I am zocha, I will eat. V'im lav, and if not, kishem shiyoguli avasi, just as my fathers tired themselves out working for me to plant trees for me, kach ani yageya levanai, so too I will work hard for my children. So what's his answer? How does he justify it? There are two dialogues there. The first one is different than the second one. What is the second response of the elderly person? Yes, very good. This is reminiscent of actually, we learned this, I got it, you may remember, a year or two ago, about Choni HaMa'agil, who meets up with this really older man, and he's planting trees. Similar ideas, similar answer. And the answer is that if I benefit, great. If not, my descendants will benefit from me. Okay. Amale, he said to him, Mechayecha, by your life, imzachis echol minhon, if you are zocha to eat from them, teve modali, let me know. Okay, the story, I'm not going to continue reading the whole story, but the story continues with that he, in fact, lived to 103. Why 3 years? What's the significance of 3 years?
Arla.
Arla, right, correct. I mean, it takes time for fruit to grow, but also there's the issue of Arla, so 3 years passes. He's 103. He says, oh, time's up. I need to tell the emperor about what happened. So he tells his family. He goes to the emperor, takes a basket of figs to the emperor, and he says, here are the fruits that I told you I would tell you about if I was able to eat from them. He gives them, yeah, very interesting point. So he gives, very interesting point, actually, worth thinking about. Anyway, he gives the basket of figs to the emperor. The emperor, in turn, seats him on a golden throne, and he tells the servants afterwards to exchange all of the figs for golden coins. So it's a really kind of sweet ending to this part of the story. The story continues, however, with a kind of like an addendum. It's quite long, though. And we'll start it. I'm not going to do the whole addendum. I wouldn't call it an addendum. It's really not fair. It's the second half of the story. It begins with the third line of the second column. Well, I should just say, everybody asks him, why are you giving him all these golden coins? And his answer is, if his God values him, I'll value him too. In any case, the story continues as follows. Intesei de Megira havas bas bras pachin. A woman in the neighborhood was a bad wife, bad person. So she, this woman in the neighborhood, overhears what happened. And as the guy comes back with his basket full of gold coins, he tells his wife, oh, look what I got. She's listening through the window or something, and she overhears the conversation, or everybody in the neighborhood knows, probably more accurately. Everybody's buzzing about what happens with this 103-year-old man and the coins and the emperor. So she hears, and she tells her husband, Amara Labala, Bar Kabloy, you fool. Chame dehada malka rachma teinin mefarga bedinarin. Look how much this emperor loves figs and exchanges them for dinarim. And she goes on to tell him, why don't you take a basket full of figs and take them over to the emperor and you will get coins. So he kind of, maybe henpecked husband sort of that he is, he does what his wife requests or demands, because she wasn't such a nice woman, and you know, that's the way the Medrash introduces her. So I guess he maybe felt compelled to do what he did. So he went up to the king and he presents himself to the king and he says, I hear you like figs, here's your basket of figs and let me have some gold coins. The story continues as follows. I'm skipping a little. Amar Kalvonin Ana Disakimun Yasei Kadam Tra Palatin. He tells, he commands, and he says to his servants, go set this guy up at the gate of the palace. V'chol mandi oil v'nafek yehetare al ape. And every person that passes should throw figs from the basket at his face. So instead of sitting him in this golden throne, he sits him at the gate of the palace, and he tells everybody to throw figs at him from the figs he brought. So he finally gets home, tells his wife what happens, skipping a line or two. Amar le'inse, k'chol ha'den yikara anash shlum lach. For all these bad things, these heavy things that happened to me, I owe you, it's all because of you that I was stoned with figs. Amara azal, Amara, she said, azil glog le'imach, go tell your mother, t'havyon inun tainin v'lo havan esrogan. It's good that you brought figs and not esrogan. To have a bishilin v'lo pagina. And they were ripe and they weren't raw. In other words, have you been stoned with esrogan, you would have been dead. So be grateful that you're only stoned with figs. Thus ends the story. So it's kind of a funny story, right? And she gets her comeuppance. He gets his comeuppance. And the old man gets his...
What's her comeuppance?
Well, I mean, she doesn't get anything, and her husband is shamed, so that doesn't look good for her.
She doesn't care about her husband's shame.
Probably doesn't look good for her. He certainly gets come up, but I mean, it's they're like a kind of like a pair. He does what I think. That's the way I read it. What? Yeah, right. What's pair? So you have this kind of like these two stories that are parallel, and the question is like, what is this Medrash trying to teach us with these two different stories? So let's first focus on the old man. How are we to understand what this old man is doing? Like, why does he plant trees at age 100 when the likelihood is very slight that he's going to benefit from them? In the event, he does. But that is remarkably unusual. So what is his thinking? How are we to understand him? Yes.
What he's doing intrinsically is always going to be valuable on some level. Either for himself, either for his kids, whatever it may be. It's like we don't have yet the mindset, I'm not going to try to do the things I can to build a base on Mikdash because it may not happen in my time. But your kids, whatever you do will be affected. And so he's doing something that has value, whether for him, whether for someone else. It doesn't really matter who it's for. But it's the fact that he's doing something that has value. And the king pays him back because what he did was something valuable.
Right.
So the other guy bringing in something that had no value because it didn't have any of the backstory to it.
Okay, good. Excellent. A very good point. Anybody want to add to that or comment on that? So I'm gonna provide you with sort of two different models for understanding the motivation of the old man. A little different from what you're saying, Mandy's saying. And one way of thinking about it is that, and by the way, let me step back for a second. What we're reflecting about is the value of work. Now, here's a guy who's working, and he's not likely to benefit from the work that he does. So why does he do this work? So one answer to the question is that he is what I would call a visionary. Because he is a person who sees for the future, builds towards the future, looks towards the future. He is not focused on the immediate benefit he gains right now from his work. That's not the kind of person he is. He is a visionary, and I can think of an excellent example of that from my own personal experience, and that is the founder of Touro College, Dr. Lander, who was a visionary in many ways. And I still vividly recall visiting him, really, aras devi, like it's on his deathbed in the hospital. He was very, very sick. And he was still calling New York Medical College and beginning to negotiate Touro's purchase of New York Medical College, even though he was like really, I mean, he died within a couple of weeks after that. He was very, very sick. He was in his hospital bed. But he was driven towards a vision that he had of the future, irrespective. He knew he would never see the actual consummation of that arrangement, which was very important for the history of Touro College. He knew he wouldn't see it because he was too old to see it. But nevertheless, he had that drive towards the future. And there are some people like that who just don't focus on the immediacy. They focus on, where am I going? What's the future? How can I bring a better future to the world? That's very, very impressive. And if I am to think of a... Now, here's where I fall into my Aesop's Fables model, and I'm going to do this for all of the this whole shiur. I would think of such a visionary as an owl. Just think of an animal metaphor. Owls are wise, and they are night animals, and they see, they function in the dark. They're capable of seeing through the dark. You know, the owl of Minerva. In Western culture, an owl is a symbol of wisdom and a vision through darkness. And so there are some people whose lives, you know, who build for the future. I mean, you think of the Panovitcher Rebbe who built, you know, Panovitcher Rug, who built Panovitch. I mean, he derived some benefit, but he had this incredible vision of rebuilding Torah in Eretz Yisrael after the Shoah. Rav Aaron Cutler, these are people who were, or Shraga Feidel Mendelovich, who built the day school system in this country. Or, you know, send people around and establish schools. Your great-grandfather. It's your great-grandfather, right? Grandfather? Grandfather. Grandfather was a Talmud of Shraga Feidel Mendelovich. He was an emissary of his to Miami. And he sent many emissaries around, founded the big school in the Alexander Gross Academy. These are people who were visionaries. They knew, they didn't think that they would, you know, it was just a fledgling movement, the day school movement, by the time Shraga Feidel Mendelovich passed away. And it eventually boomed into what we see today with schools all over the United States. So these are people who knew that they couldn't get that much benefit personally, if any benefit, or any cover in this life, but they were driven towards the future. That's one way of thinking about this man. He knows what's important, to use a term that's valuable, and he sees towards the future. And as I say, I saw that, you know, with Dr. Lander. I mean, it really made a huge impact on me personally, seeing that kind of vision. That's one model. I'll give you another way of thinking about this man and his work and the life of work. There are some people... I'll put it this way. A visionary is a kind of heroic figure, right? Planning towards the future. There are some people who are very different in their mentality. There are people, maybe your father, your uncle, grandfather, people you knew. These are people who just go to work every day. They do their best. They raise their family. They pay the tuition, pay the bills. They go to davening in the morning, you know, davening mincha marev. They may do daf yomi, they may not. But these are people who are disciplined folks. They're not visionaries. They're not thinking way into the future. They just do what they need to do. I'm a father. I have to support my family. Every day, you like a job, you don't like a job, you're thrilled with it, you're not thrilled with it. Work is ingrained into such people's DNA. It's hard for them, they may not be so interested, the salary may not be so great, but this is what they do to support their family. And they send the kids to yeshiva, and they pay the tuition bills. These are not visionaries, they're not heroic figures in the owl-like sense, the first interpretation of this old man. This is what he did. He was a farmer. What do farmers do? They farm. Whether they're 10, 20, 30, 40, 100, that's just what they do. They plant. It's a kind of a routine. which is ingrained into them, a routine of good citizenship, if I can use such a term on election day. This is what it is to be a responsible adult in the world. That, to me, is very impressive. It's not heroic in this exciting sense, but the world is built on what I would call the anti-hero hero. People who are heroic in their anti-heroism. No clamoring drums. You know, nobody's going to, you know, write newspaper articles about this guy who plants trees at 10, 20, 30, 40, 50. That's just what he does. He's a farmer. But that's impressive because he doesn't give up. He's tenacious. He's responsible. He takes care of things. And I would venture to say that some of you guys may grow up to be visionaries. Grow up, I mean, you know, mature into visionaries. Some will be like your uncle, your dad, your grandfather. You'll just do what you need to do to support your family. I would call that, and I hope this is a positive animal metaphor, for me it is, I would call such people the tortoises of human life. Who won the race between the tortoise and the hare? The tortoise won. Because the hare kept on, he was fast, quick, kept on taking breaks, sleeping, oh, I can do it anytime I want. The tortoise just keeps on plodding away. And he's the guy that wins the race. And there's something to me impressive about that tortoise-like mentality. I just keep plugging away. Nobody will break out the orchestra for me, but I do it anyway. My father-in-law was like that. When I think of this, I think he was like, work, honest, as a butcher, simple, but he did what he needed to do to support his family, and that to me is an anti-heroic heroism. And that's another way to understand this old man. My dahani lamare shmai avadah, whatever's good, whatever Hashem wants from me, benefit, not benefit, kids, me, this is just what I do. With me? Two models for understanding the significance of work in the life of a productive adult. The owl versus the tortoise. Now, how are we to look at Adrianus, Hadrian? What was his theory of work? Not the owl, not the tortoise. How would you describe Hadrian's view of the value of work? Yes, correct. I would say that, I think you're learning this in Baba Kama, what is an Ari is do res fi ochel, right? King, Ari, king of the, king of the lion kingdom, Hadrian the emperor, do res fi ochel. If you can eat it now, great, otherwise it has no value. So for Hadrian, could not understand why this guy's working. He's not going to benefit. For Hadrian, the only legitimate motivator for a productive life is what you personally will benefit from it. I don't want to get political, so I won't. But I did hear on the radio, I think it was this morning coming in, or late last night when I was getting back, that Trump said that if he loses, then this whole campaign will have been the biggest waste of life, of his time, of his money, of everything. It's a total waste. Now, again, not meaning to get political or take sides, but that to me is an Ari do res fi ochel sensibility. If you believe yourself to be committed to a certain movement, as he calls it, and a set of principles, then that has value beyond whether you win. Right? Because you've enabled people to think about politics differently. You've raised certain serious issues about the political establishment in Washington. You want to shake things up. Those, one could argue, are legitimate and valuable goals. They should remain as such, independent of whether you win or lose. Right? Doesn't this make sense? But if you are an Ari do res fi ochel, if you need to see immediate gratification from what you do, then you can say, it's all a waste of time. So I would say that sensibility that I heard in the quote from Donald Trump reflects the same Hadrianic sensibility in this medrash. If you benefit now, do it. If not, not. Don't work if you're not going to see any benefit. There's no value in work per se other than the pleasure, the gratification it gives you right afterwards. Okay, so that's the Hadrianic model. We have an owl, the visionary. We have the tortoise, and we have the lion. Three different ways of understanding the significance of making a difference in the world of work. Okay? Now, how are we to understand the model of the wife and her husband? What is their attitude or understanding of acquiring wealth? How would you characterize it?
The same sex.
Very good. Excellent. Yes. Very well put. These are the people, these are the Schmeidreyers. You know that expression in Yiddish? Oh, Yiddish. People who are looking for shortcuts, wanting to get rich quick, the schemers, the people who, you know, cut legal corners, who, you know what dray means? Yiddish? We need to show a class in Yiddish. Twist? Yeah, we should. Who twist? If we'd have enrollment, I'd try to find a teacher. In any case, people who, you know, don't play it straight. You read about them in the newspapers. The guys who are invest in penny stocks and manipulate the stock market and, you know, are not straight shooters. They're looking for a quick way to get rich where wealth is not a consequence of achievement, of what you put in, of the work that you did, of your accomplishments per se. Rather, it's you just strike it rich, get the pot of gold without doing anything for it. And there are a lot of people like that. So there are some, you know, wealthy people who manage to acquire their wealth in ill-begotten ways. Not, by the way, and when I say ill-begotten, I don't mean people who were ruthless, like, you know, Andrew Carnegie and Rockefeller. These were really ruthless people who acquired vast wealth, which they actually then used for the social, in part for social good. You know, the libraries, Carnegie Libraries, Rockefeller Foundation, whether you think it's good or bad, it's a very impressive foundation, does a lot of work. But they were ruthless people. But they were not this husband and wife. They drove to their success. These husbands and this husband and wife, they want to get it without driving. They just want to get it the easy way. Yes. By the way, I would just, to use an animal metaphor, I would call them magpies. You know what magpies are? Yes. They're birds infamous for stealing. They're always stealing, going to other nests and stealing stuff from other nests. You know, they don't do the hard work of trying to find the worms in the ground. They're always, not birds, they're always stealing from everywhere. Like they're hopping here, grabbing here. By the way, there are, unfortunately, you've probably met Frum Jews in your communities who are a bit magpie-esque, who have this, you know, get rich quick, not going to work hard, let me figure out an angle, which is not so legit, to make the money. Unfortunately, it's a syndrome. Yes?
More than that, they completely miss the point of where the money came from. They said, oh, the money came from that end result, so let's bring the end result. And they completely were blind to the fact that the things had no meaning on their own.
Right.
He wasn't paying for the figs. He was paying for
the labor.
Yeah.
Right. And the vision or the tortoise, the hair.
The inspiration, whatever it was. But the guy wasn't paying for the figs. And so, like, oh, look, you see the king likes figs. Let's go. This is the way to get him. And it was just completely blinded to the reality, to actual value.
Right. Correct. Okay. Correct. Well said. Unfortunately, there are a lot of you will meet or have met in your life lots of owls, not too many owls actually, more tortoises, plenty of ari dores viochels, plenty of people like that. And unfortunately, as you get older, if you go into the world of business, you will meet plenty of magpies as well. Okay, now finally, let's look at the Medrash Tanhuma. Flip to the other side. Is yours underlined? No,
yeah.
It is? Okay, good. So the Medrash Tanhuma is actually a much easier version of this story to read because it's mostly Hebrew, whereas the Medrash Rabbah, as you saw, and the Koheles Rabbah, which is very similar to the Medrash Rabbah, is all Aramaic, so it's much harder. So it happens to be an easier version. It's a little more condensed, same basic story outline. I'm not going to go into that. There's just one part of it that I do want to read. The Medrash Rabbah and the Medrash Tanhuma both are comments on this pasuk in Parshas Kedoshim, When you come to Eretz Yisrael and you plant. So that pasuk speaks to work. Come to Eretz Yisrael and you work. And they're troubled by the Midrashim. It says that when you get there, you'll find the Eretz is malaya kol tuv. It's full of all good things. The Jews were not the first inhabitants of the land. They were already orchards and trees planted and farms. So there's a lot of stuff there. So why should you work? So that's what this medrash is on. Okay? Why netatem if it's Eretz malaya kol tuv? You should work anyway. Plant anywhere, even if that's the thesis of both of these midrashim, and that's why the story is brought. Look, this old man is planting, even though he has stuff. So when you go to Eretz Yisrael, even though you find in Malaya Kaltov, you should still plant. That's the thesis of the medrash. It's good to work, even if it's not totally necessary. And the story is adduced to support that thesis. Now, look what the Medrash Tanhuma adds, which is not found in the Medrash Rabbah or the Koheles Rabbah. I should really read before. It's a quote for a pasuk in Koheles, which is why this is also in Koheles Rabbah. Es hakol osa yafe be'ito. Everything Hashem made. I'm reading from the pasuk. You with me? It's quoted in the Medrash. It's just above where the lines are underlined. Es hakol osa yafe be'ito. Hashem made everything good in its time. Gam es ha'olam nasan b'libam. He put eternity in there, the world in their hearts. That's the pasuk. So the Medrash observes, He'elim k'siv chaser vav. Look at the way ha'olam is spelled. He, ayin, lamed, mem. It's missing the vav after the ayin. That's mole versus chaser. Mole would be with the vav. Chaser means it's pronounced as if it had the vav, but it doesn't have the vav. So it's spelled he, ayin, lamed, mem. Mahu chein, what is the significance of this? So the Medrash reads this in classic Midrashic fashion. Ilule shakadosh baruch hu helim milibo shel adam es hamisa lo haya adam bone velo noteya. If HaKadosh Baruch Hu had not hidden. So the Medrash reads he ayin lamed mem as not ha'olam but helim, hidden. Had HaKadosh Baruch Hu not hidden from a person, what? Es hamisa, death, lo haya adam bonev lo noteya. No person would build or plant. Shaya omer, he would say, lamachar ani meis. Tomorrow I'll die. Lama ani omeid misyogeya la'acher. Why am I standing and working for others? Lefikach, he'elim HaKadosh Baruch Hu milibo shel b'nei adam, Es yom hamisa, HaKadosh Baruch Hu hid from the hearts of people the day of death. She adam bone vinoteya. So that a person would build and plant. It's very interesting, I think, as we reflect about it, a deep point. Which is that if a person knows, I'll put it first somewhat inaccurately, and then I will make my point more precisely. A person knows that he's going to die in a certain period of time, week, 3 weeks, a month, whatever it is, why should he work? So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu hid from a person the day of his death. So he thinks, oh, maybe I'll live another 70 years, or 100 years, or 40 years, so it's worthwhile working. So therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu hid from him the day of death. Kasha, why does HaKadosh Baruch Hu hide from everybody the day of his death? Let's say he's going to die, you guys are in your early 20s, let's say you're going to die at 100. 80 years from now, plenty of opportunity to benefit from your work. So why should HaKadosh Baruch Hu hide from you as a young person your day of death? See the kasha? If your day of death is a week from now or a month from now, well, then it makes sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu should hide it. But if you're a young person, why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu hide from you your day of death? It's not going to impact on your ability to work.
So it's not going to hide it from old people?
And yes.
When they were young, they would have known, and when they're older, they no longer.
Yes, so maybe, maybe it would impede their ability to work when they're, let's say they're going to live until 100. So by the time they hit 90, they're going to stop working. Okay, but until they hit 90, they can still benefit from the work. And so even if they know when they're 90, they're going to die in 10 years, but they've already put had a life of productive labor from 20 to 90. So why not tell a young person when he's going to die if, in fact, he's going to live a long life?
Well, it's not all young people have long lives.
Yes, unfortunately, you know that too well. But for the people who will live long lives, tell them.
Because then all the people who aren't told will know that their lives are shorter.
Okay, so some people know, some people don't know. No, it won't be so systematic.
It sounds like the real answer here is that God doesn't want us to waste whatever time you have left.
Right.
Who can put a value on time? And so, whatever time we have left, he wants us to use as much as we can.
Okay, that's a very good point. And I'm going to probe it a little further. Look what it says. Let's now look at the Lashon. I told you I wanted to say it a little inaccurately, and now I'm going to be a little more accurate. Ilulei shakadosh baruch hu helem milibo shel adam es hamisa. Does it say the day of death? That's what it says a little bit later. Yom hamisa. But here, does it say the day of death? No, it just says misa. What HaKadosh Baruch Hu does is, I think, and this is part of the meaning of this medrash, is that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives human beings the gift of thinking they are immortal. Everybody around at this table knows that each of us will die. But there are different modes of knowledge. There is what I will call cognitive, and then there is what I would call existential or emotional. We all know cognitively that we're going to die, but most young people, except for maybe the two of you, given what happened in your family, but for most young people, you think of, you know, you experience yourselves as being immortal. You don't really integrate that you will actually die. You know you will die. Everybody knows they're going to die. But you don't experience your life as being on the cusp of death, because typically young people live a very long time. Unless, as I say, circumstances are different. But if you look around a typical college classroom or shiur room, most young folks emotionally experience themselves as being immortal. Now, there's such a long life ahead of me. You know, I can do so many things. You don't experience yourself as really approaching death. And that is the key, perhaps, to great achievement. To the extent that people are conscious of imminent death, they are less likely to invent Apple or, invent computers or invent whatever, you know, invent a light bulb. If you think of death as approaching, if you think of death as something out there is not happening to me, then you can invest yourself with enormous energy and intensity in your projects because you don't think that you will ever end them. You just think you'll keep on working. You'll keep on Steve Jobs died when he was pretty young, actually, of pancreatic cancer. But, you know, when he was young and doing what he was doing, or the guy who invented Zuckerberg, you know, Facebook, these are people who have, you know, there's a sense of immortality in their way of experiencing themselves in the world, not cognitively, but experientially or emotionally or existentially, whatever terms you want to use to capture that point. And what the Medrash Tanchuma is saying, and now I'll switch to animal metaphors again. In order for human civilization to flourish, in order for human creativity to impact the world, we must all be blind as bats to our own ultimate fate. That we are all salutary victims of bathood, as we are all benefit by experiencing the world blind as bats to the fact that there will be death. And the younger you are, the more batty you are, if I can use that term. The older you are, like me, where you get closer to death, the less immortal you feel yourself to be, the more you weigh the preciousness of every day, of every moment, of every accomplishment, of every experience, because you experience the end of life as much closer than the beginning of life. And the Medrash's argument, and that's really the point of the connection between the Medrash and the story, this old man was as blind as a bat as anybody else. He knew he was going to die soon. He was 100 years old. But that's not how even he experienced the world. He just, you know, not necessarily an owl, a visionary, not even necessarily a tortoise, just like work embedded in your DNA, just he never experienced himself as on the cusp of death. Maybe that's delusional, but the Medrash's point is that delusionality is essential to civilization. Delusions are essential to civilization. We must all live in a world of bats, blind to our ultimate destiny. That's something that I see more as I age, and you know, you're younger, you see it less, but I can reflect back to my youth, and that's really pretty much the way I felt and thought. I remember, you know, like you just don't think about these things unless, God forbid, there is a tragedy, and that changes your perspective. It ages your way of looking at things tragically much more rapidly. But for the average person, it's like not there. It's just not there. And that is so important to enable people to flourish, that sense that there's just infinite possibilities ahead of one. And the life is one grand theater wherein one can enact the play of one's creation. And that's so important to the ability to be creative and powerful and accomplish things. So that's another model. I spoke about the model of the owl, the visionary, the tortoise, discipline, DNA, work in your DNA, the magpie, the lion, and then there is the bat. And I think all of us, to some extent, are bats. And I would make an even harsher claim, which is that by virtue of you young guys being bats, you can't even fully appreciate the sheer. Because the sheer is about the possibility of work on the cusp of death, the meaning of work, the significance of what you do with your life. And that requires a certain degree of life experience to experience, not cognitively, because you're bright guys, you can certainly understand what I'm saying cognitively, but to experience these ideas experientially, existentially, emotionally, you need to have certain life experience. And I will just conclude with this example. Josh is... Are you married?
Yeah.
What's your first name again?
Josh
is married. Josh is engaged. Seems to be a Josh thing. And there you go. So, Josh the married... can share, I think, affirm what I'm about to say, and Josh the engaged partially, which is to say that you can't know what it's like to be married until you're married. You can get 500 schmoozen from the mashgiach or whatever, or whomever, chassan schmoozen about marriage, and they're, it's not that they're not helpful. But until you experience what it is to be living with another woman, you can't, with a woman, not another one, a woman, you can't understand really what the opportunities, the beauty, the power, the challenges, the difficulties of marriage until you experience. You just can't. Not that you can't get it cognitively. If, you know, you were to hear a whole bunch of chassan schmoozen and then take a test on it, you may get 100. But that's different from the interpersonal experience of it. And that's true of some of the deepest wisdoms of life. You just need more years in order to experience what the message here. So I'm coming at this from my late middle age, and these things are meaningful to me existentially in ways that they can't be to you, not because you're not smart, which you are, but you just need to grow into this. And so your very badhood, if I can use such a term, prevents you, I think, from ultimately experiencing what it is that I'm trying to say. But that's okay, because the Torah says, in Shema, the words of the Torah, al levavchem. Why is it al levavchem and not bilavavchem? What's that? You know, the famous kasha? Yes, they need to be plunked there, even if you don't fully understand the Torah. But if it's al levavchem, then when the time comes, you will hopefully open your heart to the riches of the Torah. And I think that's part of my modus vivendi here. We all understand what I'm saying. Nothing that I said here that's so esoteric or complicated, but it requires life's experience to fully appreciate. It's al levavchem. Keep this in mind. Eventually, as you go through life and you eventually graduate and you get a job and you make your contribution to the world, do you want to be an owl or will you be a tortoise? I hope you're not going to be a magpie. I also hope you're not going to be an ari, a lion. But until the end of days, according to the Medrash Tanhuma, you will be bats.